Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Hello, I wanted to take a moment to introduce myself. My name is Mark Riccobono. I'm the Executive Director of the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our first of hopefully many Jacobus Tenbroek Disability Law Symposium. It truly is a pleasure to have you here in our facility. I think everybody has been served now, so please continue to eat. I have the privilege of introducing our keynote speaker for lunch today. I do want to take an opportunity, though, to thank the steering committee who has helped put this symposium together, working very closely with our institute staff. I also want to again acknowledge Lou Ann Blake, who has been leading the effort for the institute. Absolutely, absolutely. And while we're on it, we should extend a special thank you to our event staff who has been serving you and keeping you well fed today. So thank you to all of them. We do have a tremendous staff here at the National Federation of the Blind. The other thing that we have always been blessed with, I think if you didn't know before, you realized from the video, the National Federation of the Blind has always been blessed with great leaders. And we have been blessed throughout the years, building on Dr. Tenbroek's leadership and really the empowering philosophy that he set forth that is still our guiding principle today in the work that we do. The work that we do is different than it was in 1940, but in so many ways, it's the same. At our Jernigan Institute, our mission is to lead the quest to understand the real problems of blindness, to develop innovative technologies, education, products, and services to help the world's blind achieve independence. And we do that in many ways. One of them is through the development of this symposium, through our newly established Jacobus Tenbroek Research and Resource Library on Blindness, and we hope that one day you'll be able to log on to your university online resources, and right next to all of the other databases of information and resources that are available, you'll see the Jacobus Tenbroek Research Library on Blindness, and you'll be able to click on there and get at Dr. Tenbroek's papers and all of the other materials that we're gathering. And we have the opportunity today to help fulfill that part of our mission. So we thank you all for being part of it. We do a lot of work in the Jernigan Institute through the National Federation of the Blind. And you know, my background is not in the law. My background is more in business and developing innovative education programs. But I am very fortunate that I have the opportunity to work under the leadership of our next speaker. Mark Maurer, you can read his bio in the program, but I have the opportunity to sit with Dr. Maurer very frequently and learn about his vision. And I think if Dr. Tenbroek were alive today, and if Dr. Tenbroek had had the opportunity to know Mark Maurer, he would certainly say that Mark Maurer carries the torch forward extremely well, both in the legal realm that we're talking about today and also in the development of innovative technologies, products, services, programs, and really a vision for a social movement amongst blind people. So here to talk to us today, we have the privilege of having the president of the National Federation of the Blind. Please welcome Mark Maurer.
All right, Mark. Good. Robert Bork said, "You can't legislate morality. We legislate little else." John Adams said, "In my many years, I have come to a conclusion that one useless man is a shame, two is a law firm, and three or more is a Congress." These reflections indicate that the law is controversial and its place within society is equally controversial. Perhaps as much has been written about the nature, of justice as about any other subject. Many authorities believe that the law sets forth the synthesized standard of minimum behavior acceptable among human beings. One of the functions of law is to classify people and property. The improper classification of human beings is known as discrimination, which, when described in these terms, looks so innocent, so non-confrontational. What is the value of a human being? How is the value of one human being to be compared with the value of another? These questions have been addressed by the legal systems through the millennia. They are at the heart of the question of discrimination and integration. In the Code of Hammurabi, circa 1700 BC, disability is not mentioned, but the code does declare that if he, a man, put out the eye of a man's slave, he shall pay one half of its value. A slave without two eyes does still have value, perhaps half the value that the slave had before being injured. A slave was worthy of classification in the code, but disabled people were not of sufficient importance to be given a place in the statutes. In 1966, Dr. Jacobus ten Broek, a blind lawyer and constitutional scholar who founded the National Federation of the Blind in 1940, produced an article which was published in the California Law Review entitled "The Right to Live in the World, the Disabled in the Law of Torts." In this article, Dr. ten Broek espoused the fundamental proposition that the disabled possess the same right to live in the world that all other human beings have, and that this right is necessary to the principle of equality also shared by the disabled. After stating this essential proposition, Dr. ten Broek says that the policy of the United States is that the disabled have protection equivalent to all others under the law, to live, work, and otherwise enjoy the rights of participation in the community with all others. However, he observes that the courts have frequently interpreted the law to abrogate or at least to limit severely this policy. His conclusion is that the courts do not oppose the policy of integration for the disabled. Rather, he believes that the courts don't know this policy exists. Dr. ten Broek states that in some cases, the possession of a disability has been regarded as evidence that may be considered by a jury of contributory negligence or assumption of the risk. Although disabled people have a right to be in the world, the risk of injury while exploring that world falls on disabled people who should know better than to be in such a dangerous place. The driver who runs over a blind person might argue that if the blind person could have seen the car coming, the blind person would not have stepped into its path. The driver would not have injured the blind person. Consequently, it is the blind person's fault for being there at all. Dr. ten Broek pointed out that the right to be abroad in the land is no right at all, unless the interpretations of the doctrines of law take into account the realities of disability. Thus, the law should take notice that the blind cannot see or not see very well, that the deaf cannot hear or not hear very well, and that the wheelchair-bound cannot walk or not walk very well. To say that the wheelchair-bound have equal access to public buildings, but that the only way into them is up a flight of stairs, is to confront the disabled with irony. This reminds me of the position taken by the United States State Department before 1990. The State Department said that all applicants for employment were considered equally. All were expected to take and pass an entrance examination. The entrance examination was offered only in print. The State Department said that it did not discriminate against the blind because it offered blind people the same opportunity to take the test that it offered the sighted. Those blind people who offered to take the test by using a reader were told that this could not be done. All applicants were expected to take the examination by reading personally a printed document with their eyes. No discrimination, said the State Department. Everybody has an equal opportunity under precisely equal conditions to take the test. This is a similar argument to the one currently being offered by the Apple company. Apple has created the iPhone, one of the most important and useful pieces of technology to provide access to information that has ever been invented, according to Apple. This device is not usable by the blind. Before it had been manufactured and distributed, the National Federation of the Blind encouraged Apple to make it usable by blind people. Apple refused. When we later complained about the inaccessibility of the product, Apple said that it was fundamentally a visually oriented product that could not be used by the blind. Because this product is fundamentally visually oriented, Apple said, there is no requirement to make it usable by blind customers. Apple did not comment on the reality that gaining information from the screen of a cell phone can be done in non-visual ways. Gaining information is not fundamentally a visually oriented activity. The law must recognize that there are alternative methods of getting to the same place in physical facilities or information systems. As part of his effort in 1966, Dr. Tenbrook drafted a model white cane law, which has been adopted in a number of states. That law declares it to be the policy of the state that the blind and otherwise disabled have a right to be in any public place to which members of the public are invited, subject only to the restrictions and limitations applicable to all persons. Carrying a white cane is permitted, but not carrying it is not to be regarded as evidence of contributory negligence. In 1973, the Rehabilitation Act became law. Title V of this act lists a number of civil rights protections for the disabled. Section 504 prohibits discrimination in any activity receiving federal financial assistance. This provision has been amended to apply to the federal government. Under Section 504 of the Act, an individual could sue for enforcement. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was adopted. This act expanded dramatically the civil rights protections available to disabled individuals. Many of the principles incorporated within the civil rights sections of the Rehabilitation Act were included in the Americans with Disabilities Act. One of these is that reasonable accommodation must be an element of policy when considering disabled individuals. If an alternative method of achieving a similar result can be used, reasonable accommodation principles require it. The State Department type argument that print is the only available method for taking a test when an effective alternative would be to use a reader, braille, or recorded forms for the examination is evidence of discrimination. In 1998, amendments to Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act were adopted to require technology purchased by the United States government to be accessible to the disabled. Undoubtedly, additional legislation is needed and will be proposed. The current classification of disabled individuals often assigns to them a place in our society which does not provide equal opportunity. Despite the language of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, disabled people do not have equal access to all of the activities of life, all of the advantages to be gained through the acquisition of property, and all of the benefits of liberty that come as a necessary part of full enjoyment of equality. The Constitution of the United States has been inadequate to afford disabled people a proper classification to encourage full integration and equal opportunity. Dr. Tenbrook's article suggested that a policy of integration be adopted as one of the elements of law with respect to the disabled. Equality of opportunity for the disabled was the objective. Implicit within Dr. Tenbrook's argument and a part of the philosophy which I urge to be implemented in civil rights litigation is the notion that disabled individuals have value equivalent to that of the non-disabled, and that the performance to be expected of disabled persons is of equivalent value to the performance of the non-disabled. Equality of opportunity is essential. Equality of result is unjustified. Equality of opportunity cannot be achieved unless a recognition of the variation of characteristics involved in disability becomes a part of the policy of integration. After the adoption of Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, regulations to implement this section were drafted by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. These regulations required reasonable accommodation from covered entities. In the case of disabled employees, employers were expected to make modifications to the employment standards which might be required for the employee to perform the work in question if a reasonably similar result could be achieved thereby. For example, if a blind person were taking messages for sighted people, the employer might be required to buy a typewriter for the use of the blind employee. Blind people are often not competent to take messages in handwriting. Although a typewriter might cost much more than a box of pens, in the circumstances of a job requiring a person to take messages, the purchase of a typewriter might be reasonable. What is reasonable to request from an employer became the subject of almost endless discussion in certain circles. Could an employee alter a job because that employee has a disability? How much change is a reasonable change? And how much change alters the position altogether? How much cost must an employer bear? And how much is beyond reasonableness? Blind people do not use light, but sighted people do. Is the installation of light fixtures for the sighted a reasonable accommodation? The rules established for interpretation of Section 504 said that an accommodation need not be made if to make it would cause an undue hardship on the employer or if to make it would alter the fundamental nature of the job in question. In 1988, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit decided the case of Carter versus Bennett. The holdings in this case are that, though reasonable accommodation is required, the accommodations requested by the employee are not necessarily required of the employer. The employer is required to make such accommodations as may be necessary to permit the employee to perform the essential functions of the job in question. If a requested accommodation places an undue burden on the employer must demonstrate this to avoid the requirement of providing the accommodation. The burden of demonstration then shifts to the employee to show that the requested accommodation is not unduly burdensome. This case states what appears to me to be a reasonable set of principles. However, one element of the case is a set of facts and a standard enunciated by the Department of Education upon which the court makes no holding. The plaintiff in the case was a blind person who was serving in the Office of Civil Rights. Those employed in this office to answer letters from members of Congress or the public were required by the standards of productivity to produce 12 letters per week. However, the blind employee, as a reasonable accommodation for his employment, was expected to produce only 6 letters per week. His supervisors found his work unsatisfactory and he was dismissed from employment. The court upheld his dismissal. However, the court did not comment on the reasonable accommodation standard put in place by the Department of Education. That standard required of blind employees that they produce no more than precisely 50% of the productive work expected of sighted employees. To say that such a standard is reasonable is to accuse the blind of being non-productive. No rational employer would accept such a standard. And if such a standard becomes a recognized part of so-called non-discrimination principles, no blind employee can expect a job except as a matter of charity. That differences between the able-bodied and the disabled exist is manifest. However, the disabled and the able-bodied are not essentially different from one another in the characteristics that make people what they are. Disabled people are a cross-section of the community of human beings. We are as bright and as dull, as energetic and as lazy, as generous and as parsimonious, and as fun-loving and as boring as anybody else. Sometimes we do our work or pursue our avocations in a way different from the able-bodied, but our productivity must be as great as that expected from others, or the thought of equality for us is a myth. What do we need to compete with others? In the activities of living, working, and studying, we need access to the programs, activities, public facilities, and sources of information that others enjoy. We need acceptance of the reality that our talents are valuable and that we have contributions to make. We need to be recognized for the people we are. We need sufficient understanding of the special characteristics that we possess to enable the members of the public to value the alternative methods we use to accomplish our work. We need to be seen as sufficiently valuable to the community that we are welcomed within it. Access to public buildings is not sufficient in itself. We must be expected to be a part of the activities within them once we are admitted to the buildings. Equality of opportunity requires access to sources of information and the means to manipulate that information. What does equal access to information mean? The disabled have been seeking answers to this question for a long time. Is it necessary for all material produced for a public meeting to be presented in Braille? Is this necessary even if no indication has been given that any blind people are planning to attend that meeting who have learned to read Braille? Do all public meetings include a requirement that interpreters for the deaf be present, even if no indication has been made that deaf people will attend? Should all television programs be made with interpretation included for the deaf? Should all television programs be made with audible descriptions included for the blind? Can a library of print books be maintained without having somebody available to read the material to a blind patron who wishes to use the library? Can a department store place goods on its shelves labeled in print with no method for a blind person to learn what those goods are? Can a museum create a display of paintings without providing an audio description for the blind? Can a chamber orchestra produce an evening of Baroque music without providing a visual description for the deaf? Can a computer company sell a machine that provides access to the internet without configuring it so that it can present the information auditorily for the blind? A coherent set of answers to these questions can illustrate what equality of opportunity means for the disabled. Some of our most well-known public buildings incorporate grand staircases, which help to give them the striking appearance that they have. The law does not prohibit the building of such staircases, but it does require such buildings to have entrances that can be used by people who are not able to climb the stairs. Furthermore, although some have tried to implement such a standard, it is, in my opinion, not acceptable to tell the disabled that everybody else may enter at the front door, but disabled people are expected to go around back to enter the building where the garbage goes out. It is hard for me to imagine a visual description of an orchestral performance adequate to convey to the deaf the sound of the music. It is also hard for me to imagine an audible description of a painting that will capture the nuance of light and shadow that, I am told, is frequently an element of art. Many people have told me that they cannot imagine how the average blind person can do the average job in the average place of business effectively. Is my failure to be able to imagine a visual orchestral performance or an audible description of a painting an admission of incapacity? Or does this reflect comprehension of something real? I expect to be open to new ideas regarding the integration of my fellow human beings into society. And I believe that this should be one element of the law. In 2002, the Department of the Treasury was charged with discrimination for producing non-tactile currency. Judge James Robertson ruled in 2006 that discrimination had occurred. At the heart of his decision is the statement that the blind cannot identify the currency by touch. Blind people must employ a sighted human being to identify the currency or a technological device to do so. At the time the judge's decision was made, such technological devices were not always accurate. The judge's conclusion is that the blind cannot use the currency independently and that the knowing production of this non-tactily identifiable currency is an act of discrimination. The cost of reconfiguring the currency system of the United States is estimated at hundreds of millions of dollars. However, we live in a country with hundreds of millions of dollars, and the question to be answered is, do we want to spend the dollars to change the form of those dollars for the blind? If we do, what will the benefit be to society? And is it worth the price? If we do not, what will the cost be to society in human degradation? That blind people use the currency of the United States every day is abundantly obvious. The judge's assertion that we are denied the benefit of or the participation in a program of the federal government is overstated. What are the implications of such a decision? Do all objects need to be identifiable by touch to avoid the charge of discrimination? Are there any limits to such an assertion? The application of law changes with changing circumstances. This is necessary for the development of society. The law of negligence is a product of the Industrial Revolution, it is said. The law of civil rights came from the abolition of slavery and the alteration of conscience and class associated with the labor movement. The disability rights law adopted in the United States and copied in many other countries and now incorporated in the United Nations Convention, is almost entirely civil rights based. Whether this body of law will be a blessing or a curse depends only in part on the language of the statutes. In 1966, Dr. Tenbrook declared that a proper understanding of the reality of disability would demand a policy of integration of disabled people within society. He expected that the disabled who are being integrated would have certain obligations. If integration carries with it a burden out of proportion to the advantages to be gained, the policy will fail, and the law will find a method of employing the language of integration without giving effectiveness to it. The judges will say one thing and do another. Some disabled people seek retribution in the legal system. The argument they make is something like this: I am disabled. Disability has been used from the beginning of time to exclude those with disabilities from participation in activities of society. I am not participating in the activities I desire. Those conducting such activities have an obligation to make them accessible to me. They have not done this to my satisfaction. They owe me a place in their program. The element that is left out of this summation is the concept of performance. Those who seek inclusion within society must demonstrate sufficient value to justify being included. Society should offer equal opportunity for participation. Society need not provide equal participation. The disability rights movement has been promoted by disabled people. Most of the judges and most of the legislators who have written the language of the law and judicial decisions regarding disability have been non-disabled. However, the plaintiffs and the people who urged the adoption of the laws have been disabled. How the laws are interpreted in the future will be determined in large measure by the plaintiffs who claim the protection of the law, and more particularly by the counsel who represent them. It is up to us to decide what we want the world to be. Whether it is a hellish or a heavenly place will depend on the actions we take. We must claim only as much as is fair and reasonable, and not more. Most judges do not understand disability. Mystery surrounds this subject, and in an effort to have some recognition of the basic ability of disabled people, outlandish claims are sometimes made. Can the blind feel color, hear the vibrations of the visual spectrum, identify people by smell? Some have said we can. I recommend what Dr. Tenbrook offered, a policy of integration. We should demand all those accommodations that are necessary to gain this policy. We should demand that information sources be made readily available to us. We should be given access to physical locations, and we should expect to participate in the programs that occur within those public places. At the same time, we should expect to pull our weight. We should avoid claiming that because we possess some disability, somebody else owes us something without our being required to earn the right to full participation. Nevertheless, that right should always be available to us, and we should always be prepared to fight for it whenever somebody tries to take it from us. We should avoid being depicted as objects of charity, and we should reject the notion that we are victims. Victims don't fight back, and they aren't fun to be with. We do, and we are. We should demonstrate the strength we have, and we should demand to be recognized for the people we are. This is the attitude that will gain for us the recognition we deserve as the fun-loving, inspiring, valuable people we are.